Today is Sunday, November 20th, 2022. This is part 35 of a Grand Canyon oral history with Jim Haggart. Jim spells his last name H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Excellent, Tom. I hope you're doing well.
Yes, thank you. Good to hear it. You're doing well. And may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Jim, last time you had taken us up into the spring of 2018 and talked about, I think it was Charybdis, is that, no.
Charybdis, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, Charybdis.
Yeah.
Yes. And then what happened?
Well, yeah, so in the spring, Mark and I had the successful ascent of Charybdis, and first ascent, and then came back, and it was late in the spring when we did this, and it was quite hot, as you may
yes.
recall from my description of it. It almost it was like one of the closest I'd come to being on the edge, you know. And but anyways, so after that, we each returned to our respective places in Canada, Mark and I, and then I'm not sure if I mentioned that, you know, within a few weeks after that, so when I came back to Phoenix with Mark to go to the airport, we visited with my mother, and you know, she really liked Mark, and he liked her, too, and so, but within 3 weeks of that visit, my mom had passed away.
Right.
And so that was June 18th, I think it was. And so I was back down in Phoenix for that, of course. And it was kind of, you know, very sad for me. Obviously, yeah. it's your mother, and I had kind of, you know, counted on my mother, depended on my mother for so many of these hikes. You
mm-hmm.
know, she stored equipment for me when I was in Canada. And you know, there's stuff that I wouldn't use up here, and
right.
and so it was very, of course, you know, and there's the attraction one has for one's mother,
sure.
you know, the love one has for one's mother, and
sure.
and so anyways, it was just a very sad time all around, and it kind of it almost marked, well, certainly marked a turning point of some sort, but I did manage to get together with Mark in the fall of 2018, and to do some more climbing. And in 2019 I got together with Mark. In the fall of 2018, I was going to go hiking with Art in early December, and the plan was that I would fly down and meet Art, and then we would go and climb Thor Temple, which neither of us had tried before, and Brahma Temple, which we had tried to get up to but didn't have enough time once before. We did on a trip with other objectives. So that was the plan. Of course, by the time I flew down to Arizona, the nice fall weather had kind of evaporated, and it was kind of marginal. And we're looking at the forecast. And, you know, they were forecasting some snow, and Art basically said, I'm not interested in this, you know. He said he just wanted to go on hikes that would be comfortable and relaxing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, fair enough, I understood that completely. So I just decided to go on a solo hike to Thor, and I reduced the objectives, and I figured I'll just try and climb it myself.
Because
I'd seen the bulk of the route up through the Red Wall, and then the south face of Thor. I'd scoped that out with binoculars over the years, and
so,
I knew that the
Jim, I'm going to jump in here and say, can you remind me where Thor is?
Yeah, for sure. So it's quite straightforward to get to, because you just hike to Phantom Ranch, and then you follow the Clear Creek Trail.
Okay.
And Thor is on the east side of the main arm of Clear Creek. So it's just below the north rim, a place called Honan Point,
okay.
and west of Cape Royal a few miles. So it's a very, I won't say it's significant, imposing, because when one looks at it from many places, like the south rim in particular, from the south rim, it just kind of blends into the background behind it. It's just a Supai Butte, right?
Okay.
And goes up through virtually all the Supai, not quite, but pretty much all the Supai, and it's not separated, you know, significantly like many of the buttes are that make them really stand out, separated from the rim. So, but nonetheless, it is a nice looking summit, right? And of course, it's on the map,
right?
And so it's a destination in its own right, just for that purpose. And so, over the years, I'd hiked with Art in Clear Creek quite a bit, and gotten views of Thor from many different directions. And it seemed like this would be a fun little jaunt. So I used my mom's car, which had been stored at my sister's house. And drove up to the canyon area, stayed in Tucson the night before, and then in the morning went over to the backcountry center really early and parked there and got the permit.
Okay.
And then started down and took the shuttle to the South Kaibab Trail and started down that, and made pretty good time. And the objective was just to get to Clear Creek that day, So I managed that quite reasonably. The thing is, with the December timing, you basically are running out of light by 6 o'clock.
Right.
It's dark, and you have to kind of keep moving to make sure you're going to be able to set up a camp and find a nice spot in the twilight. But of course, I'd spent enough time in Clear Creek; I knew exactly where I wanted to camp.
And, okay.
And it was downstream from the main campground there, and on the west side. And there's a break there that goes up through the Tapetes on the east side of Clear Creek.
Okay.
And so I figured I'd camp right below that, because that was my objective for the morning, was to go up that break. And I got there and had a fine night sleeping under the tarp, just for warmth. Not for anything else, but the snow, I wanted to mention here, the snow, you know, which had precluded Art from joining me, there had only been about an inch of snow on the South Rim the night I was at Tucson,
okay.
the night before. So by the time I got through the Kaibab, the snow was pretty much gone. I mean,
right.
there were some places on the north slopes where it had accumulated a little bit, but there was very little, right?
Okay.
And which bode well for my climbing, but it was kind of unfortunate that Art had decided against it, because he thought it was going to be worse.
Yeah.
And I really would have enjoyed his company on this trip. So, anyways, I camped down there, and it was cold, but not debilitatingly.
Yeah.
So, in the morning, I got up. In the dark, actually, so I could be on my way at first light, and I had no idea how long it was going to take to do this thing. So I got going at light, first light, to head up this break, and it's a very simple, easy break. You work your way up the Talus slopes to the base of the Tapetes, and then walk around to the west, and there's a nice climbing break there. You have to climb up over ledges and little overhangs of sandstone. It's all very simple.
Yep.
It's all very simple, but it's very enjoyable, and so that gets you on top of the Tapetes. And from there, I knew that the route up through the Red Wall, I had scoped it out many occasions hiking in the canyon, and there's a drainage that's south facing drainage that's southwest of the summit of Thor by about a mile and a half or 2 miles, I guess, and. It looked like, from a distance, it looked like it had pretty good breaks in it. And I'd heard some suggestions that other people had gone up this break before. And it wasn't definitive, but, it looked pretty reasonable. So I started up for that from the top of the Tapetes, and followed up along the rising slope heading up to the Red Wall for this break. And as I mentioned, it's a south-facing gully, so it was nice and warm, right?
Yeah.
In the sun, and it was great, a great sunny day, and it was a little windy, but not terribly so. Mm. And the red wall there is pretty neat. It's like three different steps, so you go up a little, you go up gullies or faces, and then there's a horizontal ledge between each of the each of the steps, right? So, you gradually ascend that way, and it's all very straightforward. I'm sure that deer could handle it. I suspect, but you do have to use your hands and feet. So I was up to the top of the red wall pretty quickly, and relaxed there, and then started along the ridge towards Thor, and I could slowly see it coming into view. There's a smaller peak to the southwest of Thor that rises up above this red wall drainage, and that kind of obscures the view of Thor immediately, right? So I walked along the northwest side of that peak there, and it was fairly steep talus on the Supai slope, and with the frozen snow on some of the shaded areas, it was a little interesting, with the lightweight shoes I had on, but nothing serious. And so eventually I finally came around to where I could get a good view of the south face of Thor. So I looked up and at it from below, and I could see there's, five bands of Supai, and it looked like each of them got progressively harder. And I picked out what looked like the most logical line. And my, Thor was first climbed by Alan Doty in the 70s and solo, and I didn't think this was going to be too challenging, so I didn't think it was going to be a roped climb, because Doty had done it without ropes, and so I started up, and the first three bands I negotiated pretty straightforward. They got increasingly difficult, but when I got to the fourth band, I thought, this is looking really steep, again, this is on the south face, and so I looked up this, and it's like 30-foot, 40-foot climb, maybe at 70 degrees or something like that, and I could see the holds, many of them anyways, cracks and stuff, and I started up a few, 6 or 8 feet. But I just didn't like the feel of it, right? Being solo and whatnot, and I didn't have a rope. If I was managed to climb up, and didn't want to down climb, I wouldn't be able to rappel, right? So I said, well, this is not going to work, and so I backed off there, and I thought, well, I'll look around and see if there's other opportunities, options. So I hiked to the to the east and southeast along the base of the lower cliffs there of Supai to look for any route on the east face. Mm. And when I got to the corner, I looked around, and it looked very, very negative. And, of course, the map, too, supports the idea that face, the east face, is very, very steep. So I, based on my view, I thought, I don't think it's going to happen. And I thought, I guess I'm going to have to come back with a rope and a partner and do that climb I backed off of. So that's what I did. I reversed my route and went back down. And it was frustrating. But again, you've heard many of these stories from me. Pardon my dog barking there in the background.
No problem.
Yeah, you've heard many of these stories of frustrations amongst the successes, and this is just one of the frustrations. So I reversed the route and hiked back down and got to my camp there, where it was still late in the afternoon, but still enough light. I thought maybe I could bolt up to Pete's, up to the Tonto platform on the Clear Creek Trail, and get a start on the trip out in the morning, which is what I did. So I put the pack on and then hiked up, and it turns out that there's not a whole lot of great camping spots on that Clear Creek Trail, but I managed to find a place in the dark. I had to put my headlamp on and for about 15 or 20 minutes, and I finally found a place that was off the trail sufficiently that I wouldn't, you know, and I knew I was going to be getting up early, so nobody would be coming by me, you know, that I don't like to camp there and have people walking by in the morning or whatever. It's just kind of disconcerting for everybody. So anyways, that's what I did. I camped out there, and then the next day just did the quick trip back to the South Rim. Mm-hmm. So you know, it was again a disappointment, but I did check my notes and my correspondence from Jim Ullman.
Okay.
And I should have done this before the trip. Because in the notes, Jim said that, and this was some time ago when I corresponded with him about this, but he said the route is on the east face, the route he went up.
Okay.
And he did say in the notes that Doty's route went up the south face, which sounds like the one that I attempted.
Right.
And so it sounds to me like if I had pushed around on the east face a little bit farther, I might have seen the more reasonable route that Ullman had found. So,
right.
A little, you know, a disappointment and also a lesson. And again, I've had so many of these lessons over the decades. You'd think I would know to exhaust all sources of information before a trip.
Mm.
But partly, you know, I like to keep it a little raw.
Yeah.
And not so focused on details and data. And, you know, it works out fine in the end because it's always a good experience,
yeah,
right?
It's so, it's an expedition. It's an exploration.
Yeah, exactly. So, but, you know, I'm not getting any younger, and I always had the ambition to do 125 summits in the canyon, and you know, every time I try one and don't get up, it's a disappointment. I know,
yeah.
I know I can do Thor. It's just I've got to you know, get there on the right day with the right people and the right equipment and
yep.
et cetera, and it'll happen. So, but I just, you know, I'm hoping I have another 25 years of this in me, which is kind of unlikely, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it was a nice trip, you know, fun trip, and got to visit with my sisters at the end and with Art and so that's always a great way to wrap these things up. So,
nice.
So yeah, and then Tom, we're kind of, it's hard to believe, but we're getting to the end of this journey.
Okay.
And there's only one more hike that I did.
What did you do? When was it?
Yeah, and so this one was in the following year, in October of 2019, so just before COVID.
Okay.
And so, you know, I've talked many hours with you about the climbs that I've done and the ones I wanted to do, and I think I've always maintained to you that Hutton has always stood out for me.
Hmm.
Since I first saw it in the early 70s when I hiked down Quaggan Creek from the rim. And Hutton, so it's just been a real shining objective. And you know, I described one hike in 2017, I guess, before our Charybdis ascent, where Mark and I tried to climb Hutton and got rained off. We got within like 30 feet of the summit and got rained off. And, you know, well past all the challenging climbing. And so Hutton is a technical climb. It's about 5758, and it's pretty. It's composed of red wall limestone, so it's good holds,
okay.
But they're sharp and they
yeah.
can rip and tear. And so, anyways, I thought in the spring of 2019, I thought, let's try and do this next fall, right? And so I organized that way out with Mark way ahead of time, so that we'd have maximum opportunity to pull it off. And so he flew in from Ottawa because he was doing his doctoral work at the university there. And then I flew in from Vancouver. We met at Sky Harbor.
Cool.
And so we, you know, we always visit with art after these things, and particularly to borrow equipment, because art has a ready supply of ropes and, you know, jumars and things like that that are useful to borrow, and then you don't have to ferry this stuff down on the plains, right? So tarps and things like that. So we stopped and visited with art, and then went and bought food and for our trip to go into Hutton. And by the time we were leaving Phoenix that day, it was pretty late. So we wound up staying at a hotel in Flagstaff, and which was fine. And in the morning, we headed packed up and headed north along the Echo Cliffs and then the Marble Cliffs, Vermilion Cliffs, excuse me, and got gas there and then headed down the House Rock Valley Road for the Saddle Mountain Trail.
Right.
And so, you know, we'd been through there the first time that Mark had hiked anywhere, and it was on the attempt of Hutton the first time. We had been through there, and there had been the fire just very recent to when we were there, and so everything was charred at that time. And this attempt was a couple years later, and so it was starting to green in. And it's really kind of neat to see how fast that happens, you know. I don't know if it's characteristic of, you know, high desert climates that a burn is followed very quickly by revitalization, rejuvenation of grasses and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it was really neat to see.
Hmm.
Obviously, the trees are charred and standing there, but you can see the life, and it was a nice contrast to our visit of a couple of years prior, when it was just a total moonscape, a hellscape of death, right? So, so anyways, we loaded up the packs and then hiked out up the trail there to, well, you know, you hike up a road now. It's the old road. You used to be able to drive up this road a couple miles past where you park today.
Right.
And it's steep, but, you know, everybody got their Volkswagen bugs up there in the day, and now you have to do that extra hike, which is, you know, challenging, but it just adds a couple of miles to the overall walk. And then you walk along and drop down into Saddle Canyon, and these trails are all in very fine shape now. It's very impressive to see how many people are hiking in these areas. Based on the quality of the trails, right? Like the trail up from Saddle Canyon to the Saddle is very, very obvious anymore. And it used to be that you would lose it in the Ponderosa Pine periodically. I mean, not always, but, you know, there would just be enough Ponderosa Pine needles and duff accumulating that it would obscure the trail. And it was obvious where it went. You would just continue up the slope, and every once in a while you'd find a switchback or something like that.
Yeah.
But now it's all just really, you know, incised and not deeply, but it's very obvious. And unless it's covered with snow, and then you have some guessing to do. But anyways, I noticed that this time again, that the trail is very, very straightforward and easy to follow. And but still just a really beautiful experience. It's one of my favorite trails because you're hiking up through this Ponderosa Pine Forest, and you look across the Saddle Mountain, and you have the white cliffs of Coconino over there, and the forest is everywhere, and you always get a breeze coming down through that saddle.
Oh, nice.
And it just kind of, you know, sets up a nice moaning in the Ponderosa Pine. So it's a great, great place to start and end a hike for my money anyway. So,
super.
Yeah, anyways, we got to the saddle, and we started down from there. And, you know, it's kind of interesting nowadays when you go on these places, you tend to run into people, and we did find people. You know, we met a couple of people on the trail going down. They were coming out, and but it was pretty obvious we weren't going to get down to the drainage because we'd, you know, gotten a late start from Flagstaff. And so we camped on top of the Red Wall.
Okay.
And so, you know, now just to preface this, the objective was Hutton, but we also wanted to do Ehrenberg and Malgosa, which we had tried to do a couple of years prior, and had to can in the same time that we bailed off of Hutton because of the weather. So, yeah, this was the idea was to try and finally knock off all three of these. And so the next morning after we camped on the mesa there, we started down the trail, and we were moving fast. It was really good, and we tend to hike separately. I hike that way with Art too. You know, you hike at your own pace, and eventually you connect. You know, you catch up with the other guy, and then you share some info or whatever. And then, anyways, that's the way Mark and I were hiking, and we got down to the base of the trail there, the Nanqui Trail, and headed across the terraces to bypass going down to the creek and save a little bit of time that way.
Mm-hmm.
So we're heading to the southwest now to connect with the upper part of Nanqui Creek. And when we got there, we took a break under the nice cottonwoods, and then we continued up. And we have a camp. We had a camp that we stayed at or we utilized on our first trip up there. And it's down. It's right at the mouth of the drainage that comes down from between Hutton and oh my goodness, I can't. Oh, Swilling, that's it. So Hutton and Swilling.
Oh, okay.
And so that drainage, which is a route to go from Nanqui Basin into Quaggan Basin, by the way, and. So there's a nice camp there that we found under a juniper, and if you know how to get to it, it's very straightforward. The problem is there's a lot of not bamboo, but the willow and it's pretty much willow, I guess. Some other. My mind is going. Anyways, it's a very fast growing, brushy, dense. Plant that you kind of have to crash through, grows very, very prominently around water sources.
Is that the Baccharis or the small coyote willow?
I can't.
Not tamarisk.
It's not tamarisk. No, it's more of a reed. And
The Phragmites, the grass, the desert, the big.
I can't believe that.
Okay.
I've got. You know, there's mental lapse here. If it comes back to me, I'll circle around to this. But
sure.
Let's not waste time.
Okay.
But the point is that it's very dense to crash through this stuff, and sometimes you know you find deer trails, or in maybe Western Canyon you'll find like a burrow trail through this stuff. You know, but this area there's none of that, But we have a nice little camp there, and the reason I'm going in on this at length is because it plays into a little story with Art's Light Register. So, we found our campsite and dropped our gear there, and the plan was, okay, we're going to go up to Ehrenberg first, just the way we planned to do it last year. And then we'd come back down, and the next day we'd do Hutton, and then we'd go over into Quaggan drainage, and then the next day after that we'd do Malgosa. And the weather was looking fine, perfect, and when we got to this campsite, we actually found the register that I alluded to earlier that Art had given us for Hutton, for Ehrenberg, and we had placed it in the tree, in the notch of the tree, and in case for when we came back. And it turns out that I think Jake Daly had subsequently done Hutton before we did.
Okay.
And Art gave him a register. So we had this excess register to deal with, and no problem because it didn't have a name on it or anything like that. We could take it out with us. Anyways, we found this register that Jake had spent many I won't say many hours, but we had told him that this register was in the tree.
Okay.
And he looked for it quite a bit. Oh, you know, he did a special trip down there to try and find this register, and when he couldn't find it, he went back to Art to get another one. So a lot of work on his part that you know, it's just – eventually we used Google Earth. This is interesting. We used Google Earth to kind of identify – the area of the bench, the terrace along the side of the creek, and you could actually see the specific tree.
Oh, wow.
That, you know, we had camped under and where this thing was. And we sent that to Jake, but by that time he'd gotten a new register from Art. So anyways, one of the values of Google Earth, I guess. You know, we had a relaxing evening. No rain this time, no snow, so it was kind of, you know, nice. And we started, got up early in the morning, had our rack for the climb up Ehrenberg. We didn't really know what to expect because the climb on Ehrenberg is, for the most part, it's like a third-class chimney.
Okay.
But getting into the chimney is a very awkward step, and I'd been up there, as you know, many, many years before when Art and I climbed, and also Bruce Grubbs, climbed Swilling and Dupa Buttes. We climbed Novinger and Alsop Buttes. And I walked around on the big Broadway ledge that is a horizontal ledge in the Redwall that leads around to the base of the chimney. Mm. And I could see, you know, the step up. Of course, I didn't have a rope with me on that occasion, so I didn't pursue it. Came back down and joined the other two guys. But Mark and I had our gear, and we left our camp, started up the drainage of Nankoweap, and headed up, climbed up through the Tapeets, and started up for the Redwall Ridge that comes down north of Novinger Butte. So this ridge then separates, or is on the east side of the drainage that goes up to Hutton. And I'm sorry, goes up to Ehrenberg. If you find what I'm saying confusing, be sure and catch me, because I know I'm making mistakes here, and hopefully I'm catching most of them as I say them. But now we're trying to get up to Ehrenberg, and we're right heading up this drainage between Ehrenberg and Novinger. And
okay,
because of the fire that had been in there, it was extremely slow going. The slope was totally unstable, you know. And it's kind of interesting to think about this, because I never really had experience. I wouldn't have guessed that would be the result of the fire, that the slope of the Taos was totally loose. And I guess it's because all the constraining grasses and roots, you know, that kind of hold the soil in some sort of integrity.
Yeah, sure.
Are burned out, and so therefore there's nothing, you know, to hold this soil together.
Right.
And they talk about that, you know, that the worst thing after a fire is to have a rainstorm, because you get these big mudslides,
right?
Particularly in desert or temperate environments. And so, anyways, we were working our way up these slopes, and it was just super slow going. And you know, Ehrenberg's pretty high up; it's several thousand foot climb from the bed of Nankoweap.
Uh-huh.
So we were not going as fast as we wanted to. Eventually, it got to the point where I just said, look, I don't think we're going to make it. You know, we're not going to get back to our – if we continue, we're not going to get back to our camp in any reasonable time.
Got
so
it.
So I said, I think we need to just to blow it off. And so we did. And we hadn't even gotten up to the base of the Redwall yet, but we did – we did when we finally got into the bed of this drainage that goes up between Novinger and Ehrenberg. We quickly walked down it and then found the route that goes down to the bed directly below north face of Ehrenberg Point. And so Art and Bruce Grubbs and I had done this like 20 years before when we went up and did Novinger and Alsep. And I remember very distinctly that when we came down, well, the three of us did Novinger, and I did Alsep on my own. And they started down to the bed of Nanquip before me because I was on Alsep and then poking around on Ehrenberg. But I followed their tracks coming down, and all three of us got down the gully there by third classing. And when Mark and I came through in 2019, we had to rappel. I don't know what it was. You know, maybe we just didn't find the right face or whatever, but I'm certain we were in the same gully. It's another example of how, you know, you look at a rock pitch or a face in a slightly different light or a slightly different perspective, and it just doesn't look like it's going to go. So, I mean, it was no big deal. It was just a short little rappel, right? And there's a tree there and whatnot. So it was over in 15 minutes. But it's ironic because many years before we had just third class down that, and I think Harvey third classed it too. It's a Harvey Butchert route that he found in the 60s. So,
okay.
Anyways, just interesting perspective there. And so we got down to the base of the out down to the valley below, and followed the creek back down to our camp. Now, when we were there, thinking ahead, we did find there's a big boulder that's got an overhang on it. That's right up. It's just below the north face of Ehrenberg Point. So, if you go back, that's the place to camp, right? And then you get up in the morning, and all you do is you start going up immediately, and you're going straight up to Ehrenberg. There's none of this approach business, and so that's the way we're going to do it next time. So, see, I'm trying to be optimistic about this.
Yeah, why not?
Okay, but the trip was still young, right? We still had opportunity, and the plan was to go back and try hunting the next day. So, you know, we got up in the morning, and we had the plan was to go up and climb Hutton with our camp gear. And before we climbed Hutton, we would drop the camp gear in the saddle below Hutton. And then after we climbed it, we'd come back down, get our backpacks, and then descend to the south to go into Quaggint drainage.
Okay.
And then from there, the next day, we'd go down to Malgosa. So
it was
a good plan, I think. And but it made for slow going up to Hutton, you know, carrying full load. And, of course, you don't have water right away in Quaggint, so we had to have water for a full day, you know, with us and carrying all that up. But you know, we made it up there and stashed our packs in the saddle and then worked our way up to the base of the climb. And you know, I'm happy to report that this time it went like magic.
It was very
straightforward. And Mark did all the critical leading, again, you know, particularly the crux pitch. And I think I had a little bit more challenge with it the second time I tried the crux pitch, but managed it without slipping or falling or anything like that as a second, right, on the rope.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, we got to the summit, and it was just a very, very satisfying accomplishment, you know,
nice.
To finally be up there after decades of thinking about it. And of course, you know, with the disappointment a few years prior of being rained off within 25 feet of the summit.
Yeah.
And you know, Mark is such a gentleman. He did all the leading of the technical climbing there, and then he insisted that I do the last 30, 40-foot scramble up through the final red wall blocks, you know, to get on the summit of Hutton and to be there first, right? First in the team. In the team.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's a joke almost, but it's still certainly a level of courtesy, right? And,
yeah.
And
nice.
that I certainly appreciate. So,
and congrats
but anyways,
to you
it
both.
Was, you know,
yeah.
It was just such a wonderful, successful accomplishment at that time. And quite honestly, you know, considering that I haven't done any hiking in the canyon since that trip, it's kind of like the best one to have at this point, right?
Right.
if it turns out it's the last one, it's certainly one of the highlights. So.
So when you reached the summit of Hutton,
yeah,
what was the tally of your named buttes?
Okay, that was 103.
Okay.
Yeah, 103. So I've got a long ways to go.
Not quite done.
No, not quite. But lots of plans, lots of ambitions, and mm-hmm. you know, my health is keeping me is good, right? So I think it's great actually.
And how old are you now?
I'll be 69 in March.
Okay.
So this trip is not over because you know, we were supposed to go to
Malgosa, right.
Yeah. So we did the rappels off Hutton, and we knew where they were because we'd done them in the rain, you know, a couple of years before. And packed all our gear up and started down into Quoggins. And I think I've talked in the past about the water hole that one can get to in Quoggins, about a kilometer or a mile upstream of where we came down from Hutton.
Okay.
We've always found water in there, Art and I, in pretty much every season. But Mark and I, we had enough, and we knew we could get water going downstream, and
mm-hmm.
so and that was closer to our destination, so we just bolted down the drainage for you know, to get as far as we could in the fading light. And so we got essentially to the spring that's down below or you know, a few miles down Quoggin there.
Yes.
And set up our camp there where we had that source of water. So the next day the plan was to do Malgosa, tick off another one. So we got up early and packed our camping gear away and just put it in our backpacks and left them stashed at the campsite, and carried our climbing rack up to what, you know, on the approach to Malgosa. And we were still some distance from Malgosa, and we had to do some traversing of the through the Precambrian slopes there with the sandstone and shale and whatnot. It's all nicely covered with pinyon juniper and grasses and whatnot. But it was some distance, and you know, the sun was getting to us, and we finally got to the Butte Fault, where the red wall is brought up in vertical fins.
Right.
And so, you know, we rested there for a little bit of time, and we could see the mass of hut of Malgosa standing up above us there. And the first thing you got to do is you got to get through some upper supine cliffs. So it's kind of neat. You climb up onto this red wall spine, really. It's all because the red wall has been pushed, you know, dragged up vertically, and it's all eroded into spires, and you know, you have to be kind of careful climbing along these things because they break and crumble, and they're sharp and whatnot.
Yeah.
And so then you eventually pass through the red wall, through this kind of almost like a forest of red wall spires, and then you get on the other, you know, to the side of the fault, the edge of the fault zone, and the strata starts to level out again. And so at that point, then we hiked up the upper part, to the uppermost part of the Supai cliffs. And so we're looking around, and we see some cairns, right? And we start following the cairns. And so we're poking around, following these cairns and trying to find a way through these cliffs. And nothing is panning out. It was just unbelievable. Here's an example, Tom, of, you know, where cairns can really send you in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
I don't know what those Karens were for, but there were enough of them there, and they were in a place where it seemed like it was for climbers. And, you know, what I think what happens with a lot of hikers is they start on a route, and they are Karening it, and they get someplace, and they have to turn around, and they reverse their route, and they don't take the Karens down.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
And so, anyways, we thought the route went through here. We, you know, we had all the beta about the route in the Coconino, where the technical climbing is.
Right.
And so the assumption was, or what we thought, you know, was you just follow and, you know, pick out the natural breaks in the supine, and it would be obvious. But it wasn't obvious. And so we're poking around, and eventually, you know, we're looking at the clock again, and I'm saying, we don't want to bivouac up here, you know.
Right.
And we've got to get down to the bed of Quaggan to get water. So at some point, you know, we had to pull the plug on it again.
Oh, wow.
And which was a drag after carrying all that gear down there,
yeah.
You know, and whatnot. I mean, it was the same rack as for Hutton, so I'm not. It's not like it was a total waste, but you know, it's still a lot of work. And so we did reverse the route and then got back to our backpacks and then started down to the Valley of Quaggan below. And as we're going down there, I look up, you know, just this glance up to my right. And I could see where we'd been poking around to get through this Supai cliff, this band of Supai cliffs. And then I could see that if one followed horizontally below those cliffs into the next bay to the north, there's an easy break.
Yes.
Up, right? And it's just like we were so focused because I think we were distracted by these cairns that, you know, my basic canyoneering sense just kind of shut down. And it's like, if you don't see an obvious route, you continue around the corner and look over there, you
That's
know?
Right.
And it was just like, once we saw that, we knew we could have just cruised right up that, you know, and maybe it would have been a long day getting down to Quaggan Creek with the headlamps, but we would have made the climb. So
yeah.
Anyways, just another example sometimes it doesn't work out.
You'll know exactly where to go next time.
Yeah, for sure. And that's why I'm putting together this guidebook, right?
Okay.
So that people won't make these mistakes, right? And but on the other hand, I've had a tremendous career of hiking and in the Grand Canyon in support of climbing trips that never were successful. So I'm not, you know, I don't want to diminish the value of not necessarily finding the most direct route all the time. So.
Yeah.
But anyways, to make a long story short, we bailed on Mount Gosa and then carried on down to Quaggan Creek, and then we had enough time to make it up and over into Nankoweap, and we thought. And so we started on the route that goes up. I call it the Mars route because it goes up to the west of Nankoweap Butte. And not Nankoweap Mesa, but Nankoweap Butte, which is a smaller
yes.
Feature. And when you get to the saddle above, that's to the southwest of the summit of Nankoweap Butte, it's just all this shale, and with sand pieces that have eroded out of it. In fact, I'm looking at a picture of it right now. And blocks of sandstone
right.
sitting in this shale, and it's all red sand, right? And it looks exactly like those
oh, wow.
pictures that the Mars rover was broadcasting years ago when they first sent that thing up there. And you'd see all this you know, sandscape with hills off in the distance and all these boulders and cobbles of sandstone right in front of you. Obviously, it's a little bit different because here we've got the tremendous north rim of the Grand Canyon rearing up behind you.
Right.
But it still is very evocative, you know. And my friend Art took a picture years ago of when he and I went through there, of me in front going down to the northwest from the saddle, and it's just a great shot. I'm looking at it right now, and again, it just looks like those rover pictures, and that's why I call it the Mars route. But anyways, Mark and I went up through there, and when we got to the saddle, we had agreed that he would go up and climb Nanqueep Butte.
Oh, okay.
Because he had never climbed it, right? And so I continued down the drainage, and it's one of the nicest, easiest hikes you'll ever find in the Grand Canyon, and because it's just a gentle shale slope the whole way down to Nanqueep Valley. And,
right.
And so when we joined up at the, you know, at the lower end of that, and then got to the valley of Nanqueep Creek just at dark. And,
okay.
So that was pretty much it. I mean, the next day we packed up and headed up Nanqueep Trail to Saddle Canyon, and you know had a fairly standard ending to the trip. So Hutton was my last ascent, and but I haven't given up, and I'm planning to do more. And I hope you and I have, I hope you're interested in hearing them if we.
I would love that
when they do happen.
You bet.
So,
what's your planning now for your next hike?
Well, Mark and I have actually talked about going into Nanqueep again to get Malgosa and Ehrenberg,
okay.
Plus a couple of others. And and you'd think this would be in the spring, and you'd think this time we're going to be lucky because we know so much now that we didn't know before, right? And there's a possibility I may go down to Arizona in the next month.
Okay.
And if that happens, I want to visit with my family there and that I haven't seen for 3 years. And if that happens, I'll probably connect with Art, and we'll do something. I'm not quite sure what. Maybe in the Western Canyon where it's a little warmer.
Uh-huh.
And like in the Havasu area, I'm not quite sure, but we'll see. You know what transpires. There's always, he and I have tried to do Castor Temple,
okay.
From the South Rim, and didn't get up that, so that would be a logical destination. And there's a few here and there on the South Rim that I'd like to do. So, but no formal plan at this point, except for Ehrenberg and Malgosa, and with Mark. And Art, if he wants to go along, but he tends not to get involved in the technical climbing. So
yeah. Okay.
So yeah. Hopefully that'll happen. And I have plans to do many, many more, Tom. You know, I haven't done Vishnu, so I've tried like four times to do Vishnu, it's never materialized. So that's a big gap in my education. You know.
Okay.
Zoroaster's another one, and even Thorin and Brahma again. I mean, Art and I could conceivably do that next month. You know, the two of them in a trip. I know he really wants to do Brahma. So,
okay.
Yeah, there'll be more. And like I say, you know, I'm in great health, and the cardiologist tells me you can go anywhere you want in the world and do whatever you want. So
great.
I take him at his word.
Yep,
and,
absolutely.
Yep.
So I kind of want to stop for a minute here and ponder this, thinking about the backpack that you did out of the Fredonia Hotel heading down Kanab Creek.
Oh, yeah.
Back in 74.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we talked about that, huh?
So you're closing in on 50 years of hiking in Grand Canyon.
Yeah, that's true. I don't really think of it that way, but it's true. Yeah.
And I want to kind of know what this landscape has done to you. Kind of open-ended question there.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much to say about that, Tom. I mean, I was a kid then, and. And, you know, very impressionable, and my mind was a blank slate, you know. And so I think it's safe to say that these hikes, in particular these Grand Canyon hikes, really motivated me to go into geology as a career.
Okay.
And, you know, that has been a tremendously satisfying career for me. Even now, this past summer, I found brand new geology just north of Vancouver up in the Coast Mountains here. And it reworks the story of the tectonic history of this part of the world in a major way. And it's
cool.
Like, you know, the only reason I found that is because I can go still go hiking up in these places, you know. But anyways, the canyon really inspired me to take that career on. And you know, I can recall, I may have talked to you about this over the hours we've been on the phone, but there were certain hikes I did in the 70s when I was in college and learning geology, and it was like, wow, you know, that's, I can see right here in the real rock the things the professor was talking about, you know, the pictures in the books are right here. I can see the real thing. And it was just such a you know, an awakening and an illumination for me on how the world, you know, works, how it was formed, how it has been transformed over the decades and millennia, and so, you know, I've never lost sight of the fact that the canyon is just such a wonderful example of geology in action. You know,
nice.
Like consider when Art and I were down there in Quaggan about 10 years ago, and we found this debris flow that had come down from the Red Wall to the southeast of Quaggan there on the opposite side of the drainage, and you know this debris flow that you could at the source, it was moving boulders that were like the size of small houses, right?
Yeah, they were
huge.
And
then you could follow. We were able to follow the debris flow train, the sedimentary material that was carried in the debris flow, all the way down Quaggan Creek, almost to the Butte Fault, where it was down to, you know, like sand-sized mud, and then eventually petered out. And to me, it was just such a fantastic display of geology in action. And
Art
you know, I would never have seen that.
Yeah, Art had told me about
that. I could read about debris flows, but I would never have seen that had I not, you know, had this experience of a lifetime of hiking in the canyon. And you know, and at the same time, you see these things, events like this, so infrequently,
right?
Or the evidence of these events, so infrequently that you realize that these are relatively rare things. They don't happen every day,
right.
You know? And that just gives you a sense of the magnitude and depth of geologic time, you know? This is one debris flow, and there's been hundreds of thousands, millions of debris flows in the Grand Canyon through its history, but this was one.
Right.
And you could see, you know, the evidence of it directly, and yet for the previous 50 years, there hadn't been any other debris flows in that area, right?
Right.
So anyways, it's a very, very wonderful example for that. But then again, you know, there's so much more that that comes out of these hikes, you know, the sense of accomplishment when you push yourself to a struggle to achieve a goal, and it comes to you, and you get it. And it's very, very satisfying. But then if you fail, well, then you realize, well, you know, there are things I could have done better, you know, to plan for this. I'll try and do that next time, you know. Maybe we should have just skipped this trip because the weather forecast was bad and, you know, we didn't get lucky. So we got the snow instead of the mist. And all sorts of things like that, you know, go through your mind. But It's overall, it's just been tremendously satisfying as far as accomplishments go. I mean, I can go on and on about this. You need to cut me off when you're ready here. But, you know, at first when I started hiking in the canyon, I just wanted to do all the trails, right? And that seemed really cool to be able to hike all these trails. And when you're doing this, you know, you're thinking about, oh, well, this is where John Hance was mining, you know, and this is so cool that, you know, that pickaxe over there that's just laying on the side of the adit, you know, that was Hans's pick, and you know, you're experiencing history directly, right, in physical form there, And it's just, for me, I find that a really exciting link to the past. Now, that's the recent past. When you see the evidence of the Anasazi, mm-hmm. you're going even farther back,
right.
right? And, you know, to find pictographs and find routes like the Comanche Point route up on the South Rim there, where the indigenous folks put up a route, and, you know, it's really spectacular. And they built little steps to move up on and mm-hmm. improve the efficiency of their traversing. And, you know, that again, it's a link there with history.
Yeah.
And it's like I can walk with those fellows and women who were, you know, harvesting yucca down below and then maybe carrying it to the rim. I'm not sure what they were doing, but
mm-hmm.
but or I can be at Hans's mine site, you know, when he was mining asbestos there. And these are really tremendous experiences that, you know, that really provide a sense of satisfaction for me as an individual. So
nice. Yeah, good. That's a good answer. That's what I'm looking for.
I guess there's no right answer. It's just different perspectives, right?
No, it's going to be uniquely personal to every individual.
Yeah. And the other side of it, Tom, I've mentioned this many times in our discussions, is you know, the camaraderie.
Yes.
And, you know, the such a positive experiences you have with other people, you know, during these events. Like, I think all the time about when Scott Kronberg and I did the first ascent of Tower of Set, and we had to bivouac under a supine ledge in a snowstorm, and we
right.
just watched the snow falling all night long, and there was this tremendous rock fall of red wall in the amphitheater directly below us. And, you know, we could see the dust coming up from that rock fall. We'd heard it first.
Mm.
And we could see the dust coming up in the cavern of air below us, right?
Right.
Even though it was in the dark, and there was you know, some moonlight coming through, I guess, that it was reflecting off. But what, you know, again, here's a geological experience that you don't get to see or hear very often. You know,
right.
a tremendous rockfall like that.
Yeah.
And we got to experience that, you know, sitting together under this ledge, unexpectedly bivouacking in a snowstorm, right? And you know, those kinds of experiences, you know, stick with you for a lifetime. And you know, you have good memories of your partners and colleagues on these events. And I like to think that they have the same you know, feelings and sensations. I mean, maybe not. Maybe they remember other things
right.
that, you know, happened when we were together doing these trips than I do. But these are the things I recall, right? So. But there's a million stories like that. And, you know, I get together with my friend Chris every, you know, once in a while, every year or so. And the fellow I did my first hike ever in the Grand Canyon with, you know, and we always talk about, the jelly bean story, right? When, because we did this at Easter time he had a jelly bean that he consumed that, and not much else, in about 24 hours, and that jelly bean seemed to come up on the South Kaibab Trail, right? So, but it's a good story that he and I share,
yeah.
And you know, it's kind of like these stories are just as valuable an experience, and what they represent are just as valuable an experience as all the other accomplishments, and you know, the actual physical accomplishments, getting the lines on the map, getting up the summits, you know, getting the red wall routes and things like that. I mean, it's I just feel so blessed to have had this opportunity, you know, and to have had my parents supported me all the time I was, you know, young.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
always gave me the opportunity to pursue this stuff, and my friends have equally done that, so. Yeah, it's just it's been a great experience, and you know, you kind of get to a position like this, and it's like, well, there's going to be an end, you know. I mean, I used to think that Harvey Butcher would go on forever, you know. But eventually he came to the end, and
right.
it, you know, there's going to be an end for me, too, and I just don't know when it is, and I hope it's not soon.
Right.
I feel like I can keep going. I've got the physical capabilities, you know, and I've got the ambition. So, you know, but it's kind of going to come to an end, and it's kind of like, then what?
I just talked with Bob Packard.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I believe he's 86, and he's still climbing small summits.
Great.
So, yeah.
That's a tremendous inspiration. So that means I got at least 15 years.
He's closing in on his 3,000th summit. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's tremendous.
Phenomenal. So.
Yeah. He should write a book about that. That would make a great book.
I don't know if he's a writer, but he's a hiker. So. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully he's kept records.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, the list of John.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, maybe what let's do is we are going to conclude this interview, part 35, with the understanding that we are going to talk again after your next summit.
Okay.
Or summit attempt, whichever it may be.
Okay. Yeah, you're very wise to put that qualification on it.
Well, you never know. You've got some meaty things yet to chew on. So you know, we'll wish you all the best, and want to hear about it when it happens.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely be in touch then, for sure.
I look forward to it.
Yeah, I definitely have enjoyed this opportunity, and I appreciate you taking the time, Tom. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of effort on your part to sit there and listen and record all this, and you know, I really consider it a privilege and an honor, and
I do
so
too.
I want to thank you for that personally.
You're very kind, and it is, just like what you said, I see this as a privilege and an honor to get a chance to visit with people and learn their amazing adventures, and I thank you so much for your participation in this, and I look forward to doing it again.
Okay, well, we'll keep in touch on that for sure.
Awesome.
I'll let you know.
Well, with that, this will conclude part 35 of Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggard. Today is Sunday, November 20th, 2022. And my name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a real thrill.